Hello, and welcome to the podcast, An Intelligent Look at Terrorism. I'm your host, Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat Risk Consulting in Ottawa, Canada. And I'm recording this on the 7th of April, 2020. And I'm really very pleased today to have with me Michael Petru, who is a visiting fellow in the Global International Studies Program at Carleton University here in Ottawa. And more importantly, he's the author of a book that I relied on quite a bit some years ago. So to give you a bit of backdrop, in 2015, 2016, I was working on my second book on foreign fighters to do with terrorism groups like Islamic State. And I came across a really interesting book called Renegades, Canadians in the Spanish Civil War by Michael Petru. And Michael is now joining me on this podcast. So welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Thank you, Phil, for having me.
So when you wrote Renegades, that was way back in 2008. As to say, it's a fascinating book on, you know, why Canadians decided that going to fight in the Spanish Civil War from 1936 to 1939 was a good idea. So what did you learn about the rationales, the reasons, the justification given by Canadians back in the midst, well, I guess the tail end of the Depression, why they left their homes and farmlands in Canada to go fight for the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War?
Yeah, I mean, none of the Canadians had a direct connection to Spain, per se. They weren't Spanish. I think one out of 1,500 might have been ethnically or had family ties to Spain. But so there was no obvious connection to joining this fight the way some, you know, other people have returned to their ancestral homes to take up conflicts there. But the Canadians saw what was happening in Spain as part of this much larger global conflict between the left and the right that included even their own struggles in Canada during the Great Depression. So although it was no, I mean, Franco was not responsible for the, you know, the collapse of wheat on the prairies, they believed that the world was fragmenting between these two camps. And a lot of them were immigrants, about three quarters, and many of them have been caught up in some of these left-right conflicts that had erupted after the end of the First World War in Europe. So they saw Spain as an extension of maybe the Finnish Civil War, for example, or even, as strange as it might sound, even the Irish Civil War. They saw Spain was this screen on which they projected all these other desires and resentments and hopes. So although it was a very localized conflict and had very, its roots were in the Spanish earth, it was seen as this much larger symbolic clash that that drew in even, you know, people in Vancouver and in Medicine Hat.
You made the point about Finnish Canadians, and I'm pretty sure that most Canadians did know we had a Finnish Canadian population. But when I first visited the Spanish War Memorial, which is just on the Ottawa River, just actually down from Parliament Hill, not very far, you're amazed when you look at the names, and they come across as a lot of Finnish names, a lot of Eastern European names. And as you said, people that didn't have any natural link or homeland in Spain. So aside from this notion that they projected, as you use the words, this sort of screen, the Spanish Civil War, what were they trying to achieve by volunteering to go fight in Spain in the 1930s?
Well, you mentioned the memorial. And I mean, it's a fascinating one. And I don't think it would have been possible to erect it at any earlier than it was. It was put up in 2001. Coincidentally, I was in Afghanistan at the time. And So I think a lot of the publicity was kind of overlooked by what was happening elsewhere in the world.
And wasn't it Adrian Clarkson?
Adrian Clarkson, amazing. Yeah, like that never would have happened because throughout so much of the Cold War, the Canadian volunteers and other volunteers in Spain were seen as you know, Stalinist dupes. They never would have. And this was interesting. That kind of colored the way that they were portrayed. For example, books that were written during the Cold War tended to downplay their communism, when in fact, I mean, the vast majority of them were communists. Not very good communists, mind you. And that's another fascinating thing I found in my research is, even though most of them were immigrants, they'd only been in Canada for, you know, 10 or 15 years, they'd already adopted this very Canadian irreverence, which frustrated to no end their commanders and political bosses from other countries. When you're reading the reports and the Canadians, they'll say, you know, so-and-so is a very good soldier. He's very brave, but he's politically undeveloped, or he has anarchist tendencies, which was a dangerous thing for communists. And they blamed their situation in the Great Depression. A lot of these guys had been trekking back and forth across the country on the roofs of railway cars. It had been involved in these lumber camps. They were kind of inheriting a little bit of the North American Wobblies tradition. So they were communists on paper, but they had this certain, you know, independent streak, which you even see reflected among Canadians in the Second World War. They didn't defer to authority the way their comrades from, say, Europe or even the United States did. So they had their, even though they were immigrants, they had their own unique identity. Now, in terms of where they were coming from, you're right. I mean, a lot of Finns, Northern Ontario, lumberjacks. You have sort of certain clusters of volunteers. There was a lot from Vancouver because that's where a lot of the the relief camp workers and a lot of the kind of leftist activism was happening. Large contingent of Hungarians, a lot of Ukrainians from the prairies, a lot of Finns from Northern Ontario, a lot of Irish and Scots and British. I think that was more reflective of just Canadian immigration patterns. Very few French Quebecois, some French Canadians from, you know, that had left Quebec, but the influence of the Catholic Church was generally pro-fascism at the time. A disproportionate number of Jewish Canadians. You had some clusters from Montreal and elsewhere. Not as many Jews as, say, were volunteers from the United States, but still more than a disproportionate, more than there was their share of the population. And so they had different reasons. Like some of them, I remember one Finnish volunteer, he said, look, like I went to avenge my sister who was killed by Finnish whites in the Civil War. Well, of course, that had nothing to do with the Civil War. Spain didn't. But just when you look at their demographics and you see these huge clusters, it's not a coincidence that you had the Finns, because they'd been radicalized by the Civil War in Finland. A lot of them were communists. Ukrainians, same thing. This they're all shaken by the uprisings, some of these attempts at Soviet uprisings, communist uprisings after the First World War. Some had more sort of independent leanings. They believe that you have people saying, oh, you know, the liberation of the liberation of Spain is very much like the independence that we're seeking, say, for Ukrainians who were in areas occupied by Poland at the time. So, you know, you have a lot of Ukrainians from areas that were under Polish occupation. They saw that sort of independence and nationalism even reflected in Spain. Again, a lot of this, seems odd, because the dynamics in Spain were very different. But it was just a very fluid cause. I mean, the Irish, for example, you have all these, Irish Canadians. Most of them were veterans of the IRA. Again, like not an obvious connection, but sort of the idea of, Spanish freedom and Irish freedom. For some of these volunteers, there was a logical or a tangible or, at least an emotional and heartfelt connection between these different causes. And finally, look, I mean, all of them were suffering under the Great Depression in Canada, so they thought that, the same tools or the same system that was keeping them down and keeping them starving and, living in these relief camps for 20 cents a day, that same, capitalism, that they, they felt it. They felt its oppression in Canada was the same thing that the Spanish workers and peasants were facing in Europe. So it was a malleable cause.
And I suppose that the fact that they called themselves the MacPaps, the Mackenzie Papineau Brigades, named after William Lyon Mackenzie and Louis-Joseph Papineau, who were two 19th century, I guess, revolutionaries in Canada, both in what was then Upper and Lower Canada, Ontario and Quebec. So did they call themselves that because they really did see themselves as the vanguards of a quasi-revolutionary movement that was there to fight evil and establish the forces of good in Spain?
Well, I think the MacPaps, that was an interesting decision. I think that was very much, a public relations decision. They wanted, because a lot of them were foreign-born, right? And when you read the RCMP reports, for example, on these guys, they're very much dismissed as, disloyal, frankly meaning, not British, Eastern Europeans, they're foreigners, right? I mean, this is a time when a lot of, immigrants from Eastern Europe and the Balkans and elsewhere who were deemed, who got involved in the Communist Party, they risked deportation. They were seen as outside the Canadian mainstream. So by picking, a French and an English historical figures, revolutionary figures, yes, you're right, the revolutionary element was there. But these were also, Canadien de souche, I suppose. These were, old stock Canadian, revolutionary heroes. The American battalions were, named after George Washington and
Lincoln.
Lincoln, yeah. So, this is a very thought out decision that they say, look, we're not foreign. We're fighting your cause. We are Canadian. And it was a public relations decision as much as anything else.
Now, you mentioned briefly the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So, of course, a lot of these guys, they fought in Spain, and then eventually the war ended. Of course, Franco's forces did win, ushering in, almost four decades of dictatorship in Spain. So a lot of these guys ended up coming home back to Canada, and they didn't actually get a hero's welcome as Canadian soldiers did in, maybe 1918, and more importantly, perhaps 1945 in World War II. So what was the RCMP, and by extension, the Canadian government's view of these guys who had fought what they said was the good fight? The government was rather neutral. I don't think the government had a position on the Spanish Civil War, correct me if I'm wrong. So what did the RCMP and the sort of greater public safety national security apparatus think of these guys when they returned beginning in 1939?
The RCMP was very hostile, and they had prepared a case to prosecute the recruiters and even prosecute those who went overseas. They'd gathered intelligence, and they were ready to go. And ultimately, around early 1938, they realized that volunteers were no longer going over, and there was some discussion, I believe, with the government that this would, although it wasn't a uniformly popular cause, the feeling was that they're no longer heading over to Spain, and if we prosecute some of the returnees, it'll be bad public relations. Canadians will not be happy about it. So ultimately, the decision was made not to prosecute. And the RCMP was quite bitter about this. They viewed these guys as, again, foreigners, disloyal foreigners. And they continued to surveil them. I believe the most recent report I was able to find was either 1980 or 1984.
1980? From a war that ended in 19... That's a hell of a long
it's
file.
It's ridiculous. You have... there's this one RCMP report. I'm quoting by memory, so I might get a word or two wrong. But they're surveilling these guys who are just getting together to have drink beers, and in very formal language, it was they say things like this doesn't appear to be a political gathering; it's more of a social get together with alcohol in attendance. Thank God, relief. They no longer appear to be communists; they're following the NDP philosophy. And I thought, oh, good God, does the Queen know? So they got it wrong. I mean, the RCMP. Now, to be fair, the Soviets, yes, in the 1930s, absolutely. The Soviets, it was the communists who were controlling a lot of the volunteers, and the communists wanted to use these guys, after the war for their revolutionary activities. I mean, absolutely.
This is the time of the Red Scare, right?
Yeah, yeah. And the Soviets, they were judging people not on whether they were good soldiers, but whether they were good communists, a lot of them. And I know I spoke with an old veteran who said that he was approached by some sort of Soviet agent in Spain about doing work, for the party, some sort of secret work, after the war. He said he turned it down. And there were some American veterans of Spain who did spy for the Soviets. No Canadians did. So again, to be fair to the RCMP, the Soviets wanted to use these. They had other ideas for what these volunteers might be doing after the war, but the RCMP, I think, didn't understand what motivated the Canadians. They thought these Canadian volunteers were Soviet dupes. They weren't. As I said, when you read the reports from the commissars in Spain, they were endlessly upset that the Canadians were not good communists. They were anarchists. They were Trotskyists. They were irreverent. There's a I remember a joke I read, allegedly a commissar, so this is sort of political boss in Spain, asks a Canadian how the coffee is. And he says, well, it depends, comrade commandante. If I'm politically developed, it's very good. Otherwise, it tastes like horse piss. Right? so these were who the Canadians were. They were not, you know, Ottomans. They came back, and there were a few. And to be fair, there were a few, you know, hardcore communists. There was at least one who worked for the Soviet infiltrated or controlled secret police in Spain. But they did not want to come back to Canada and launch a revolution here. And the RCMP never really understood that. They never really understood their motivations. So their surveillance reports were, way out in left field. At one point, they got a hold of some, veterans organization, mailing, pamphlet talking about supporting Republicans in Spain. I forget exactly if it was with money or food packets or something. And they somehow managed to suggest that this indicated that the veterans of Spain were planning on, reforming a battalion to go back to Spain and fight again. So they really misunderstood, and they grossly exaggerated the threat that the Canadian volunteers posed to the Canadian state and just the public order here. We can get into why, and I'd be speculating, but I think at the time, a lot of the RCMP was dominated by, Anglo-Irish. There weren't a lot of people that were, part of the communities that were, they're going to Spain, these Eastern Europeans and stuff. So I think they misunderstood what these guys were about.
You mentioned that they initially had thought about the possibility of charging these guys once they returned. I'm curious if your research found out what would they have charged them with, because if memory serves me correctly, the Canadian Parliament did pass the Foreign Enlistments Act sometime around then, making it illegal to join an army and to participate in a war to which Canada was not a party. Was that the plan originally, was to charge them under this act?
I believe so, yes. Now, again, I'm not a legal historian, so I'm on a little bit of shaky ground here. If I understand correctly, the Foreign Enlistment Act, Canada inherited that, or that was still in the law books before the war began. I believe in 1937 it was made applicable to Spain. Again, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a legal historian, but my understanding is yes, it was a Foreign Enlistment Act that would have been used to prosecute these guys.
Now, of course, the reason why we're having this conversation, Michael, aside from the fact that it's fascinating, your book was fascinating, Renegades. I'll link to it when I publish this podcast. But the thing that 2020 in 2020 in the last couple of years, the thing that a lot of Canadians and by extension a lot of people in the Western world are worried about is a different wave of foreign fighters, and that of course are the number of Westerners, Canadians, Americans, Western Europeans, etc., that went to join Islamic State beginning in 2012, 2013 until the dissolution of the Islamic State in last year. And of course there's been a lot of ink spilled, a lot of analysis, and a lot of grandstanding and theorizing about the threat that these guys pose, because some went to fight for ISIS, some died, are incarcerated either by the Kurds, the Syrians, or the Iraqis, and some have returned, and there are some that want to return. So if you can extrapolate from what you learned about the Spanish-Civil War and the Canadian government's absolute almost sense of panic in the national security realm with respect to returning Spanish-Civil War veterans, can you make a link to sort of the atmosphere now in Canada and by extension other Western countries on returning ISIS fighters, or is this a completely different ball of wax?
Well, they're different, they're different folks, I suppose, in terms of their motivations and their end goals. I don't want to downplay the security threat that returnees from ISIS pose, but I have a clear-eyed understanding of what motivated the Canadians and the threat that they posed when they came back from Spain, with a benefit of, 80 plus years of hindsight. We don't have that now. So I can say that, the RCMP didn't understand what motivated the Canadians in Spain, and this caused them to grossly inflate the threat that these guys posed when they returned. I can only assume that, or I can only hope, that intelligence is much better today regarding the motivations and the threat posed by returnees from ISIS. And I think they are, personally, I think they are a, a legitimate security threat. But again, I don't have that expertise. So I mean, I think it was in 1939, there was a panic, you know, built on misperceptions and a lack of information. My belief or my understanding of ISIS and some of its adherents are that what motivated a lot of the Canadians in Spain in the 1930s was, legitimate injustice. Some of them were revolutionary. Some of them simply wanted a better deal in a situation in Canada in which they were legitimately suffering. I mean, the Great Depression was terrible. I think the motivations of ISIS adherents are much more revolutionary. And even when you read, as Phil, I know, of course, you have, and you know this far better than I do. It's not just revolutionary; it's apocalyptic. A lot of the propaganda and narratives of the Islamic State. So I think to the extent that the concern about ISIS returnees is greater than it was, substantial today, I tend to think that's probably justified. I mean, that's not to say that there aren't, ISIS recruits that, were misguided or, made stupid decisions or, followed their husband. I mean, I can accept that. But the ISIS ideology, which these young Canadians had exposure to, through very sophisticated online propaganda, is dangerous, is revolutionary, is end times apocalyptic in its goals, and the means to by which they think these goals should be achieved. I mean, both of us have read, ISIS propaganda and immersed ourselves in their actions, and these are. They endorse and celebrate, murderous means of achieving apocalyptic ends. So I think that is a legitimate reason for concern when these guys come back to Canada.
Not surprisingly, I do agree with you. As someone who used to work for CSIS and looked at this whole issue of Canadians going to join groups, I suppose one of the underlying significant differences is that ISIS was in fact a terrorist group, and there was never any real belief that those that volunteered to fight for the Republicans in Spain were terrorists per se. They may be misguided, they may have gone for a whole host of reasons, but as you said, we didn't have people who knew, or rather should have known, that ISIS was in fact a heinous, violent terrorist group. And you're right, the motivations were right across the map. Some thought they were joining a utopian society. Some people just like to kill and hurt people because that's what they're like. Others [S2] Yep. [S1] may have been duped by their boyfriends, husbands, whatever thing. So, but it is important, I think, to try to draw too many parallels between the situation 1939 with the returning MacPaps or whoever they were and those who are returning from ISIS. I do agree with you again that the vast majority of these people probably do not pose an immediate threat to public safety. The devil's in the details, though, and it's trying to figure out which one, right? If 100 people return, and if work by Thomas Heghammer, the Norwegian scholar, is any indication, 1 in 9 returning foreign fighters ends up planning something, an act of terrorism in their homelands. The problem is figure out which 1 in 9 kind of thing. So looking forward, and I guess as a way to sort of wrap this up, what lessons, if any, could we have learned by our approach? Now, mind you, it was 80 years ago, so I'm really careful not to say that what we learned back then and in the intervening years is completely applicable to where we are in 2020. But if you were to be put on the spot and say how we could have done things better then and how that can apply to now, what would you say?
Well, if I was going to be real, pie in the sky, looking back, I suppose what I would have, the big lesson for me is, these volunteers should have been supported, and not in the sense, not that Canada can support, an unofficial militia, but I do think, and I'm not a starry-eyed romantic about Spain. I mean, it was like all wars, it was an ugly one, and like all civil wars, it was particularly ugly, and I'm well aware of the disreputable characters on both sides of the conflict. But I think ultimately, these volunteers in 1936 and 37, they recognize the threat that fascism posed and resolved to do something about it. So in terms of you know, if I could roll back the clock and change history, you know, I would wish that the democracies had been similarly prescient about the threat of fascism and had resolved to confront it earlier than they did. Because look, you know, I mean, a lot of, you know, the Canadians, these Canadians who fought in Spain, they were, let's not forget, Adolf Hitler supported Franco.
Absolutely.
So these Canadians, they were fighting Nazism, you know, 2-3 years before the democracies were finally roused and had to do the same. I mean, I'll always remember George Orwell's, you know, haunting and beautiful ending to Homage to Catalonia. Mm-hmm. He talks about coming back. He's shot through the throat, and he's caught right up in the ugliness of the anti-fascist side, right? I mean, he, you know, his he escapes not just a fascist, but he escapes, you know, the Republicans or the communist-dominated Republicans. He had been involved in this sort of fringe militia, as was another Canadian who only died in the last couple of years, actually. He was with this, you know, this anti-Stalinist, anti-fascist PUM, this militia in Spain. And so he escapes Spain, and he travels through France, and he crosses a channel, and then he says, and then it's England again. And he just describes this, you know, the rolling green hills and just the sameness, you know, the comfort of repetition in England. And he says, you know, and I fear we won't be roused from this complacency until we're jerked out of it by the roar of bombs. And he was right. I mean, he recognized that fascism was coming, whether we wanted to appease it or not. And so did these Canadians. So if I could roll back the clock, you know, I wish the government had shared that awareness. Now, I think what you really wanted to hear was being what to do about the returning volunteers.
Give me the solution, Michael. Give the solution to the Canadian government.
You know, look, I mean, the lesson I think is, if you're going to make a good judgment about the risks that these people pose, you need good intelligence, you need assets who are from that community, which, you know, Canada certainly didn't have, you know, in 1936 or 39. I mean, when you're reading the intelligence reports, it's humorous in the 1980s, as I talked about, you know, they're surveilling these social get togethers. In 1937, they had an agent kind of like, you know, lurking in, well, this isn't such a bad idea now that I think about it, but, you know, lurking in these drinking establishments, trying to overhear conversations that allegedly were happening in bathrooms. But they didn't have agents on the inside. They had one alleged informer, it suggested. But, you know, this planning and recruiting was happening, you know, kind of outside the awareness of the RCMP. You know, I can only assume, you know, that Canada has, you know, much better, the Canadian security services have much better penetration, you know, into communities that are, you know, that have been sending recruits to ISIS and other, you know, and other jihadist organizations. I think that's a lesson. I think, you know, you and I differ about whether they should be allowed to come back to Canada, which is another interesting question. Mm-hmm. I think both of us recognize the threat that these guys, or most of us believe that these people pose a threat. You know, I think we need to, not we need to, I think we're obligated to bring them back as citizens anyways. And I know you differ. And that's, I suppose that's another knot. That's an unsatisfactory answer.
I appreciate your thoughts on that. Yeah. I think if nothing else, you know, you point to the fact that in many ways in the 1930s, we slept walk our way into World War II, right? I mean, people didn't think Hitler was so bad. And people forget, I'll never forget being in the Prado in Madrid and seeing Picasso's Guernica, this massive mural about the bombing of a town in the Basque country by you know, the Air Force of sort of Hitler and Franco and you know, the absolute tremendous damage and death toll. And the fact this was basically a warm-up for Second World War, and we kind of ignored it. You know, Michael, I do want to say that Renegades is an absolutely fascinating book, and I remember I found it serendipitously when I was doing my research for my book on Western foreign fighters, but it really helped me understand a whole era of history that I was only remotely familiar with. So in ending, I mean, is there, what are you working on now? What kind of era of history, as a historian, is there something you're working on now you want to share with my listeners?
Well, I have to knock on wood or hope that I'm able to land this eventually, but I'm fascinated by the echoes that the Spanish Civil War had, and there's all kinds of them. You know, even we've been talking about jihadists. One of the Pakistani ISI intelligence chiefs, who of course helped coordinate sending international volunteers to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. I remember he said, I remember reading that he said, you know, the communists had their international brigades and now we'll have ours. You know, so 50 years after the fact, he was in a completely incongruous part of the world, a Pakistani spy chief was holding up this example. And then just recently in the last week, a Spanish Republican died. He had been one of the Spanish Republicans that liberated Paris in 1944. A lot of the Republicans, you know, they had to flee. They fled Spain and they joined the Free French, right? They rolled into Paris with their armored personnel carriers with the names of Spanish towns on them, right? And then others of them, you know, went to South America, and there was echoes there. Anyways, the ripple or the echo that I'm most interested in is during the Second World War, the Special Operations Executive. Mm-hmm. This was a British outfit that parachuted folks behind German lines to liaise with resistance groups in occupied Europe and coordinate arms drops and whatnot. So Yugoslavia was this vast mountainous country where there were two active resistance groups, and the British couldn't figure out what was going on or whom to support. So they ended up recruiting about 20 Yugoslav Canadians, and at least six of them were veterans of the Spanish Civil War.
Wow.
They wanted these guys who had combat experience, who had party ties, perhaps, because one of these groups, Tito, was communist-led. So they had this whole recruiting operation in Canada and the United States, although things kind of went south in America, where they were partnering with these veterans of Spain, again, communists mostly, many of whom were, had precarious immigration status, and they recruited these guys, took them to Egypt, then they'd fly across the Mediterranean, and they dropped them into Yugoslavia. And so that story just it absolutely fascinates me. These were veterans of Spain, or people in their network of these dissident, radical, communist immigrants. And sometimes the British were cooperating with the RCMP. Sometimes they were going behind their back because, again, the RCMP did not like these guys. So I've written in the Journal of the Canadian Historical Association. I've written a chapter about the recruitment of these Canadian veterans of Spain and their colleagues. I really hope I can build on that research because it's a fascinating story. They didn't leave a lot of records, unfortunately. I have these wonderful archival documents and material from the British, where they'll say, so and so is and is full of these, class and ethnic stereotypes. So and so is full of Slavic peasant cunning, but might be useful in a fight, So anyways, I'd love to be able to tell more of that story, and we'll see where that goes.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. And I must say that the first time I came across that memorial I referred to earlier on the Ottawa River, I spent quite a bit of time there just looking at the names and looking at something that, as you said, was unthinkable back in the 1930s and 40s when these guys first came back. And now they're just seen as these little plucky little guys that did their best to try to, save Spain from what ended up becoming a four-decade iron fist rule by a dictator. So, Michael, listen, I want to thank you very, very much for joining me on the podcast. I think we could talk for days about this, and I certainly, I'm going to put a link to your book as well as the article in the journal you refer to so that my listeners can learn more about your research into the Spanish Civil War and why it actually has repercussions up to today. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Phil. What a pleasure to talk with you.
So that's it for today's podcast. I'd love to hear what you think about my conversation with Michael Petru. You can reach me on email, borealisrisk@gmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter @BorealisSaves, on LinkedIn or on Facebook. You can subscribe to all the content free of charge. Just go to www.borealsthreatenrisk.com, hit the subscribe button, provide your email, and you'll get a daily digest of this information free of charge to your inbox. I'll talk to you again soon. Until then, stay safe.